You're listening
to Welcome to Comics, episode number 305. This week, we talk about Valerian and Laureline, the City of Shifting Waters. Visit WelcomeToComics.com. Hear past episodes. See what we're reading next. Or send us feedback. This show is supported by listeners like you. Access bonus episodes by becoming a patron today at patreon.com/welcometocomics. And now,
the cast begins.
And 7 day came and went, nothing really big happened at all. But I guess Mass Effect's kind of dead now.
Yeah. That was my favorite franchise. I never even picked up Andromeda. I'm so sad.
And it was the 10-year anniversary of the franchise, too. You'd think something would have happened.
Yeah.
They came out with a commemorative shirt, and, like, that was it. A shirt. They even had it on sale. I didn't even commemorate the thing by, like, buying another statue or anything crazy. Because I'm sitting here looking at my Liara statue, which is still badass. Anyway, do you guys want to talk about this week's comic?
Wait, did anybody watch Thor?
No! Oh yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. I have a hard time being a babysitter for this one. Did you watch it, Clint?
I did. Yeah, I liked it a lot, actually. I really enjoyed it. It was, it was not what I was expecting at all. It's an oddly, like... This is a weird way of putting it, but I read this in a review and it was really well put. Like, it's a workplace comedy masquerading as a superhero movie. It's very tongue in cheek, like way more than you would like, obviously from a Thor movie, like, you know, cause it there's already that automatic, like, thee and thou, and he speaks like in, you know, that sort of Thor tongue. So it's, you know, they kind of poke fun at that in the first two movies, but they just let it go in this one. They're just like, yeah, this is ridiculous, so let's just go with how ridiculous it is, basically. Like, I think you'd really enjoy it, Andy. It's a fun movie. It's not particularly good by Marvel standards, but it's really fun. It's a really fun, funny, I laughed more than any other Marvel movie, I think, I've seen, other than maybe Guardians, the first one.
I think this one Marvel's at its best, and I saw on Reddit of, like, all of the Marvel posters, like, one after another, and it's funny because in the beginning they look like dark and gritty, and now they're, like, all super bright and fun and look like comic book covers almost. And one of the comments on Reddit was like, you know, it's amazing how now finally, like, you don't have to pretend that a comic book movie is something else. You can just have it be a comic book movie and have it be what it's supposed to be and not have to hide it or couch it in anything.
It's extremely purist for, like, comic book movies. Like, it has weird, like, like I said, it's oddly, like a niche movie put into, like, a blockbuster, like, shell. It's interesting. I mean, I'd recommend it for sure. Like I said, it was not what I was expecting at all. Like,
we did the source material, I think, because from what I understand from the trailers and stuff, the source material is like, the World War Hulk and the Simonson Thor. And we've done both of those for this, and they're both fucking
phenomenal.
It draws
heavily on Walt Simonson. I think that's why I liked it so much. They even make a reference to Thor being turned into a frog. And obviously there's the whole, like, Executioner is in it. Like, he didn't need to be in the movie at all. Like, he doesn't have that much of a function. But if you are a fan of Walt Simonson's run, that, you know, just him being there is really cool. And then, you know, he does the whole infamous scene with the two machine guns, just like in the comic.
Nice.
That's pretty cool.
That's awesome. And I mean, Thor is one of those franchises that has such a signature voice from so long that you can't, I don't think you can make Thor movies without having to make them about Simonson in some way or another. like you can't do X-Men and not do the Chris Claremont stories. You can't do Thor and not do the Simonson stories. You just kind of have to. There's such a part of the character and the history of that character's story. There's no choice.
You know, I think the like faux fancy language, like these are the thous that Clint mentioned. I think the reason it doesn't stand out in this movie is because everybody kind of talks that way, so it doesn't seem out of place. Because you spend like no time on Earth. It's all on Asgard or Sakaar, which is pretty cool. I mean, I thought that was I thought that was neat. It was a good departure, and
yeah, there's no exposition whatsoever. Yeah. Like they're just like go. Like yeah. I like that part of it.
Yeah,
it
I mean was, there's like the goddess of death, there's spaceships. There's Jeff Goldblum being Jeff Goldblum. It's
fucking great. He's amazing.
Yeah.
Oh, so good in this movie. He's hilarious.
I'm glad that there's not any exposition because I'm watching Steins Gate right now for my other podcast, for my anime podcast, on Jen's recommendation. And I'm not enjoying Steins Gate at all
it
yet.
It has eight episodes of exposition and then it gets good. I'm sorry, okay. But no, I guarantee
because as we're recording,
very good.
Yeah, as we record, like every single time that it gets brought up, I'm like we're five episodes in, and the most important parts of the entire show are when they're reading off of a computer screen.
Yeah, no, you're going to be like, you're just going to be like, oh, these people are kind of weird and otherwise boring, and then, like, suddenly shit gets real.
Good.
Like, on a screen?
Wait, did you get to the banana part? That sounds so dire.
What? Are you trying to sell this show, like, the banana part?
They have successfully hacked into CERN.
Okay.
And that's about where I am.
If you don't know what I mean in reference to the bananas, then you haven't gotten to that part. And no, it's not as...
There are gel nanas, and I know...
Okay, yes.
I know what also comes out gel from CERN.
I can only tell you...
Yeah.
That time travel is a thing in this show, and it will actually happen and be a real issue, and he's not as crazy as you think, but other than that, I mean,
I don't think he's crazy. I think he's stupid. You should listen to the show, Jen. I don't think he's crazy. I think he's just dumb.
Okay, I will have to give this a listen.
Lunch hour anime special.
And I will say, I'm not the only person who likes this show. It's like rated number one or number two on a lot of lists, so I guarantee there is something to it.
You're not even the first person to recommend it for our show. You recommended it, another listener recommended it, and then the other Jen who's on that podcast, so it's really confusing. I have podcast Jen and other podcast Jen, and I have another Jen. So, like, wow. even differentiating Jen and podcast Jen doesn't do it because I have two podcast Jens, but other podcast Jen also wanted to watch it. So we've had multiple recommendations for the show. So I'm willing to keep watching because there's no way it's this regarded, revered, and it's just on accident.
Yeah, no, hang in there. It will stress you out and then give you like very strong feelings.
Okay.
And yeah, no, it's good.
All right.
There's one more piece of news that I would like to bring up.
All right.
Lucasfilm announced today that Rian Johnson's going to create a new Star Wars trilogy that is not about the Skywalkers. It's going to be new characters and stuff, so that's pretty exciting.
That's pretty cool. I appreciate him as a filmmaker. I think I'm interested to see what he comes up with. Like, I don't know. I'm kind of worried that I'm gonna have Star Wars overload in like 5 years. But as far as for right now, like, let's go with it. Like, I'm down. But
well, I'm the listeners of the show know that I'm like I'm a Star Wars fanboy.
Like, you're a Mandalorian.
Yeah, like, I'm in the Mandalorian mercs. Like, I have my own costume. So I'm a huge Star Wars fanboy. So, like, my opinions are not the opinions of the general public. Like, if they keep making Star Wars movies forever, I'll be happy. But I get the fatigue. So, I can see where you're coming from. Oh yeah, Andy, you should probably introduce Clint to the listeners.
Oh yeah, so this is my buddy Clint. He's on the show because he's a Luc Besson fan. Like, we're reading Valerian and Loreline this week because I had seen the trailer. We scheduled this episode for this one. Like, basically, we're doing a sci-fi series to rationalize reading Valerian and Loreline because I hadn't even heard of it before, and then the trailer came out for the movie, and I was like, holy shit, this looks like awesome Luc Besson, like, Fifth Element again, and I just want the shit out of this. And so we're we're reading this now, and I still haven't got a chance to watch that movie, although now I don't have a reason not to.
You haven't watched it yet?
No, because I didn't get a chance to, like, because my wife wasn't super interested in it, so, like, I can't rationalize paying for a babysitter or ditching my wife for, like, 3 hours to go watch it. And now it's, like, by the time I'm done with, like, you know, dishes and laundry and shit, it's 9 o'clock and I don't want to stay up for another 3 hours. So, but at this point, I just need to watch it at work.
I haven't watched it either.
That said,
I don't feel bad. I still have the second Thor movie on my list to watch and I haven't gotten around to it. So some of us are just behind.
You can
just
Dark World?
Just skip it.
Yeah,
honestly.
Really?
Just watch Ragnarok.
Yeah.
There's only like one piece of information that carries over into the next film that is relevant at all.
All right.
And it won't
it's
be
not, just, it's not a particularly good movie. Yeah.
It's you could skip it. And you won't lose out on anything from the new one.
Okay.
No.
That's kind of sad, but yeah.
Well, like,
I like that. I kind of like that they're standalone movies more than, I have to have seen all 8 of the Thor movies for this one to make sense. Like, I kind of like that they, you can jump in and out, like, as you see fit, sort of. They're more standalone Avengers than
yeah, I mean, like, I would like if, like, the Thor movies were connected to the other Thor movies. What I don't like is, like, for a while I was feeling I had to watch all of the Marvel movies.
Right.
And that was like around the like Winter Soldier Civil War kind of a thing, and I'm like, I don't have time for all of this. Especially because then started tying into Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Sure. And I'm like, too much.
Yeah.
I haven't watched Spider-Man yet. Spider-Man Homecoming.
Oh yeah, me either. But that I just, yeah, that's fine. I'm gonna watch that on Netflix. I'm not worried about that one at all.
Definitely worth a view if you're a Spider-Man fan, though. It's great. It's like old school. Old, like, classic Spider-Man fun adventures. Like, it doesn't take itself too seriously. It basically was like, hey, what did, you know, the last two Spider-Mans get wrong, and we'll get it right this time. I think they did a really good job with it.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, so anyway, Clint is guesting on this one because he's a Luc Besson fan and a huge film buff. But I don't think we're going to talk about the movie because I haven't seen it and Jenna hasn't seen it.
Okay.
But I was like, you know, we'll have him on anyway because he's a cool guy.
Okay. I did read the comic, so we can...
Yeah, you know. So we'll talk about the comic.
This week's comic.
This week, we read City of Shifting Waters, The City of Shifting Waters. Which is a really cool title, but also really hard to say. Which is the first graphic novel in the 21 graphic novels, 21 in the Valerian and Loreline series. So I'm excited because I kind of like this, and there's like 20 more of them now, even though they're like from the 70s or some shit. So it's good. I have a nice deep hole to go down.
They're old.
Man. Andy, what's the names of the creators?
Pierre Christin and Jean-Claude Mezières, with colors by Evelyne Tranley. I was doing so well until the end. Evelyne Tranley. Yeah. Pierre Christin and Jean-Claude Mezières.
Awesome. Good job, Andy.
I just want to hear you butcher that.
I butcher so many names. Apparently French isn't among them. Yeah, so this one, what did you guys think of this? Did you guys like it? I kind of liked it.
Yeah, it felt super classic in, like, a very good way. It felt very, like, you know how in Golden Age sci-fi stories, like, things are either get, like, really dark or kind of are more lighthearted? This felt lighthearted despite the circumstances, and I enjoyed that about it.
What, yeah, you know, I like that ahead. For that. I like the same thing. I enjoyed the kind of classical feel to it. It was very, like, I had to keep kind of reminding myself not to take it as seriously as, like, you know, a comic book from the last 20 years or so. You know, that it was, you know, I think it was written, what, 67, 68, I think, right, Andy? Something like that.
Don't put me on the spot. That's what Amazon's for.
Oh, sorry. I don't know. I thought you were the host or something. I forgot.
Technically true.
I think it was 78.
Okay, 78. But even then, like, you know, that's kind of before comics got sort of gritty and dark. It did have a very gritty sort of, like, feel, like the subject material, but it kind of tackled in a lighthearted way, and it's kind of refreshing to kind of read something like that after modern comics, where everything it seems to be pretty dark these days.
DC.
Yeah.
How about you, David?
Yeah, I really like this. You know, it. I haven't read a ton of European comics, but this does, like, the art style and the feel of it is similar to, like, Tintin, in a good way. You know, it's different than what we usually read, and even other, like, American comics we read from the 70s, this feels a little bit different. They do have a lot of dialogue in common. Like, yeah. You know, when we read, like, 60s and 70s Spider-Man, there's, like, blocks and blocks of dialogue, and this has the same. But this didn't feel, it didn't feel overwhelming in the same way that some of the old comics do. And I think that's because this is something, at least for me, that's kind of completely new. Whereas I'm used, you know, when we read stuff like, you know, 60s or 70s Fantastic Four, Spider-Man, I'm used to reading modern stuff, and that the way that stuff, it's like the same stories are kind of delivered in a different way, and my preference is the way modern stuff is delivered, you know, with kind of like the unreliable narration plus the dialogue, and in this it's just kind of dialogue with no exposition.
Yeah, and I mean, so. talking about comparing to, like, Spider-Man's a great example, because, like, when we read The Death of Gwen Stacy, aside from the title spoiling it, I mean, we knew most of the details, and so it's difficult knowing so much of it, and then going back and trying to read it, and then realizing just how much of it you already knew, and so the exposition takes extra long because you already know. So it's like, oh my god, this is like taking twice as long. Not only is it a huge block of text that's unnecessarily large amounts, considering this is a comic book and you're supposed to be telling me with pictures, but also I already know all of this. This is nice because even sometimes it gets a little text heavy, a little exposition-y, but at least for us, at least it's all fresh story. So it's not, it doesn't have the problem that something like a Spider-Man does. But I want to bring up something to talk about with you guys, something that Jen said about how this is an old comic that kind of feels comfortable, but also doesn't get weighed down the same way that a lot of old comics do. And I don't know if that was the exact point, Jen. I'm just trying to circle back. One of the things that I always wait to happen when we read an old comic is sexism. I always wait for it because it inevitably happens. Whenever you read something before, like 1985, terrible sexism comes up. And here, it comes up, but it gets jabbed at in a way that I find really interesting. Because, like, Valerian says something like, you know, you women are so much better at this, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, okay, that's kind of just like token feminism. But then Valerian says, or Laureline turns around and she says, you know, you're right. We are more valued or we're better because we cook the food. And I'm like, oh, there it is. There's the sexism. And then she's like, see how well I have opened these tins.
Yeah.
And I really like that.
Really good.
It plays back and forth. I feel like it was an intentional play on my expectations of sexism. That, like, there were a lot of scenes with Laureline that I think played on what I was supposed to assume was going to happen, or if I didn't know it was going to come, like, jabbed at it in a way that was interesting and that would have engaged me if I were a sexist asshole.
Well, I know that the series actually got a lot of recognition for that, it kind of a very feminist forward thinking, like played with the sort of like, you know, like classic heroic tropes of like, you know, like you were saying like, oh, here's where the, you know, the masculine jocular hero would make some kind of sexist comment, and then, you know, like, that would be not played on in a normal thing, but, you know, this, it actually got, like, a lot of recognition, for being very forward-thinking at the time. So it, I could see how, because even if, like, you know, 78, that's a very sort of, like, even then, I don't think mainstream comics, especially in America, had that sort of forward-thinking attitude towards female characters and how they're written and how they're seen, basically.
Yeah, they were really... American comics were generally quite bad about that kind of thing, honestly.
Yeah. Even up until, like, the 90s, they were pretty bad, like, in that regard.
I mean, even today, sometimes you find things that are lit.
Yeah. Oh, God.
I mean, I love Power
Rangers. It's better, though. It's gotten a lot better the last 10 years.
Absolutely.
Go.
There is just one more scene, Andy, that I thought was really good, where she gets, where Loreline gets shrunk.
Mm-hmm.
And then she's like, why does this always happen to the women?
Yeah.
And instead of, like, taking it somewhere super creepy, she just, like, goes back to normal size. And then they, like, rip her clothing, and then, you know, they don't lampshade that, actually. So, but at the same time, it's like, okay, now she's wearing shorts. So it could have been so much worse. And I know saying, like, oh, it could have been worse is not really a good defense, but I think it's more, like, meant to be cheeky than anything. They're like, you know, all this weird shit happens to ladies in comics, but, you know, like, it leaves the question, why is that? And I think it's... Go ahead.
I was just going to say, it also... I like that scene because it doesn't over-sexualize her either. Like, it kind of plays at it jokingly. Like, in the very next scene, she's fully clothed again. Like, you know, in a different uniform or whatever, but, like, it's played for a laugh instead of, like, ooh, like, Laureline's super hot, and, like, you know, sexualizes it into, like, this thing. Like, for the time, I think that was very unusual. It stood out to me a lot, like, when I read that.
And I think those interactions are the obvious points. Because they're pointed out and the characters discuss them. I think the other thing, like, Valerian's very much the hero of this comic. I think he's the person you follow. But at the same time, Laureline's the one who actually gets shit done and who saves him. Like, he's in serious trouble, and she's like, I showed up and I got my shit together, and I got an airplane, and I flew up here, I found you, I scoped out the scene, and I looked for the right moment, and I sprung you, and don't worry, I got this, bro. I've got everything, just relax, it's fine.
Right, the point is she's capable, like, that, and not as, like, a sidekick. Like, she's actually, like, her own capable character. And honestly, I mean, I don't mean to, like, to, you know, play down for comic audiences, but that's it is a difficult thing to do, especially when, you know, most comic books, aside from the main character, and even sometimes the main character, isn't a three-dimensional character at all. So I tip my hat to the writer. He did a really good job of making each character like their own individual voice, and I never felt like I was reading the supporting cast as just to be there for Valerian to play off of. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Even Sun Ray was interesting.
Right. Yeah. I thought the scientist was really interesting too. Schroeder or whatever his name was. Yeah. Not your typical mad scientist character, or, you know, that nebbish sort of Deus Ex Machina scientist character that, like, oh, I've got the perfect, you know, even some of his, like, devices, like backfired on them and stuff. I remember the scene with the bubbles and stuff. I thought that was a really interesting, also kind of, like, subverting your expectations where, you know, it'd be something like, oh, we're screwed, but actually it kind of like saved them. And I don't know. I just thought that was really interesting that they kind of usually, I think of older comics as not having that level of sophistication in the storytelling.
Yeah.
mean,
what did you guys think of Valerian's arrangement with Sunray? Because Sunray is clearly a bad, thuggish dude, but Valerian's like, I don't care. I'll use him to achieve my mission, and we'll both win. Maybe I just want to talk about this because I've been watching a lot of Star Trek, where it's like high morality. Like, no, he's a bad dude. He shouldn't get nice things, because bad people don't get nice things. but I like that Valerian's just like, you know, we gotta get things done here, guys. And Sun Ray, at the end of the day, probably isn't going to matter on the timeline. So, yeah, here, have some technology. You're all going to go, you know, it's going to... That's the other thing with time travel. Like, Valerian mentions once or twice, you know, like, I don't want to mess with time that much. But then he's, like, willing to give Sun Ray a crap ton of technology. So I don't know where he draws the line exactly. But I appreciated that he was willing to just do what he needed to do to get the mission done. He has an idea of the higher purpose for what he's doing there.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, he could have just, like, boarded the boat and started punching people and stolen the boat instead of working with the, you know, working with the locals. I mean, that wasn't his mission. His mission was to find the main bad guy. And so, why go out of his way to do something that isn't really affecting him or anybody else? And just, I mean, they were looting empty buildings, right? I think we just call him a bad guy because he's he's stealing things, but who's he stealing it from, right? Or who else is going to use it?
Yeah. And they were looting extra useless things too.
Valerian even calls him out. It's like, you know, you're not going to be able to buy or sell anything with all your money and treasures. And then he's like, yeah, I know. So I think they, Valerian just kind of knows what's up.
So he did have a ship full of prisoners, and he was heading up a gang of people who were like willing to shoot Valerian, implying that they'd probably be willing to shoot other people.
I suppose that's true.
I mean, I think
he's an unsavory character.
Yeah, I think part of it is mostly that like Valerian knows that this is like a really shitty time in Earth's history. And then everything turns out okay, and that's probably good enough for him. I will say that, like, it was one of the most interesting scenes morally is where they are being forced to take the hovercraft out west, and they pass by, like, a suburb house type thing, and it's flooded, and people are like, help us, help us. And then as they go past, the guy's like, murderers! And that's actually like, a superhero would have stopped to save the people, right? And here, it's just, they're like, well, nothing to do there. And they didn't try. And I thought that was interesting, because it's like, yeah, they're actually just really focused on the whole time agent aspect. And, you know, what happens in 1986 is not their problem.
Yeah.
Well, and that ties in... Oh, go ahead. Go ahead.
David, you go. I'd play referee a bit more when there's four of us.
His mission is to maintain the timeline, right? So he has bigger fish to fry than to rescue some random people that probably don't have an impact in the same way that, you know, his job is to stop this other guy from messing up the future. And I guess one you could argue that maybe those people were supposed to be rescued, and so, you know, Valerian messed up by not rescuing them, but, you know, maybe it's like, you know, the Ray Bradbury story, Sound of Thunder, where they step on the butterfly and all of a sudden the Nazis won World War II. You know, maybe if they had rescued those people, that's what would have happened or something, you know.
Yeah, I think it's a matter of perspective too, you know, like, not just that they're super focused on their mission, but like they're not just cops, and they're not just like diplomats or anything. They are space-time cops, and they have very important shit to do. And I think it's also a matter of perspective in that, like, they're from so far in the future, and they probably see, like, I don't know how time travel or the idea of it is constructed in the context of this run, but it's the idea that, like, it's just going to flow forward. Like, just time is going to move forward, and these, like, 10 people in a house, it sucks that they're going to die, but like you said, Jen, this time sucks for everybody. Tons of people are going to die, and the people on the roof are going to die with us, or they're going to probably die without us, and it doesn't matter either way in the end. They're just going to die, and to save them now just gives them false hope. It just slows us down. It just changes the content. Like, it sucks, but yeah, we're gone. Like, it's not worth trying. They're not worth the effort. It's not worth the time. We can't do anything anyway. Fuck it. They're dead. And not having to feel bad about that, per se.
But he did see the thing. For me, at least, I when I read that, it didn't strike me as particularly like odd that he would do that, because I don't think it was that he, if I'm remembering it properly, I don't think it was that they couldn't.
The boat
they weren't in control of the boat.
Yeah,
right. So it's not like he could just like stop the boat and help them and then go about his merry way, like. And it struck me as, like, Valerian throughout the book was a very pragmatic guy. Like, yeah. He was not... He valued pragmatism and, to tie it into why he trusted Sun Ra, he saw him as a means to an end, as opposed to, like, you know, oh, I'm going to be moral and I'm going to be the hero, heroic type. Like, he had a... Like you're saying, he had a job to do and he was just going to get it done no matter what. And I think that, you know, you can be a classic hero and not save everybody. Like, but, you know, on it, when that scene came up for me, at least, it struck me more as, kind of showing a contrast to like the happy-go-lucky kind of guy he was in the beginning. That he can be like no nonsense when the situation needs to be. At least that's how I read it. So, quick thing. The time travel. That didn't make any sense to me. Because in the beginning of it, they basically said something how time travel was instantaneous and easy. And then later, it was like this impossible thing that could only be pulled off under the rarest of circumstances. I didn't really understand that. Like, do you guys have any clarification that I could? That,
I don't know if I read that way.
Really, I don't know.
I from what I remember, it was really easy for them to do in the 24th century, really impossible to do in the 20th, in terms of technology and their knowledge. So like Valerian and Lorelink do it because they knew what was going on, but not really anybody else.
Right, but that, see, that was what struck me as odd, because it was like, I remember even in the very beginning, they said that travel was instantaneous and they had like thing. But then the next scene, like Valerian's like, geez, it took forever to get here. And I'm like, huh? Like,
I don't remember that.
How does it, how the hell does travel and time travel work in this? In this, because they never really go into it in any real depth, except for, like I said, I think the exposition said something along the lines of it was, I don't know, I'd have to look it up again to get it exactly, but it was something along the lines of, like, it's relatively easy and relatively simple to do. And then, that's why I didn't understand why it was so difficult for them to get back to 24th century after it was done.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe there's something about how it's the Dark Ages, because they mentioned something about relays and stuff, and I don't know what all's going on there. I think I have to learn more about this world and how they're constructing time travel and how time works. If that makes sense. Like, is this is this Doctor Who time travel or timey-wimey, whatever works for the plot this week? Or is it like something where there's a more structured sense of how time travel works?
Well, I'm looking at it, so this is literally the opening paragraph from the thing. It says, Galactic City, metropolis of the future and capital of the Terran Galactic Empire. With the development of instantaneous space-time travel, the structure of society has changed.
I'm reading that they have it then.
It wasn't integral to the story, but it was like one of those things that when I was going back to think about it, I was like, why didn't they just zap over to where they needed to be? Like, just kind of straight. I don't know.
It is actually weird that they had to go to relays in, like, New York and Brazil. But then, like, what would they have been, like, why were the relays there in the first place if time travel hadn't been invented?
Right.
Maybe it's not, like, a...
And I've gone cross-eyed.
Maybe it's not an actual thing. It's, like, they, because they don't have a time machine... Well, I mean, they do have a time machine in 1986 because they find one, but typically maybe they don't have one, and so they need to be at a certain place for their future technology to, like, beam them up or something. I don't know, I'm speculating.
It's not that there's a thing there, it's that it's more like a save point.
It could just be that this isn't the first one in the series, so maybe if we had read the first book, we would know.
I thought this was the first one. This is the first book.
I thought this was the first.
It's not.
Oh, it says it on.
There's one called that's listed as Zero that was published in 1967.
So wait, am I the only one that saw the movie?
No, I saw it.
Okay. All right. Cool. Yeah. Oh man, I'm so frustrated with that movie. I kind of want to talk about it, but I don't want to, like, spoil it for anybody, so I'm just like, ugh. I don't know. That was one of the most frustrating movies I've ever watched in my whole life.
I heard that from a lot of people, and it's why we didn't see it in theaters.
Yeah, it's one of those movies that, like, I feel like if it had made a few changes, it could have been amazing and brilliant. But, like, I mean... Just the one that really stands out is not really spoiling anything. Like, the guy they got to play Valerian is just... You could not have cast a worse guy for that role. He was just... I don't know how you feel about it, but I thought he was just terrible.
Yeah, he wasn't great.
Yeah. I pretty much figured you could stick anybody else in that role. Like, decent actor, you know, A-list actor, and it would have been a much better movie.
I do remember seeing the trailers and thinking that kid did not look like an action hero at all, and then he just looked like kind of slimy.
Oh, I was like, yeah,
maybe he's like an anti-hero kind of a character or something, I don't know, but like after reading this, like, yeah, no, that was just a bad cast. Just after reading the comic, I'm like, that doesn't fit right with how I see Valerian in this. I see him more as like a Bondy kid kind of a thing.
Was it one of you guys who said that they all looked really sweaty in the trailers, and it was a big turnoff?
Yes.
Was that you, Andy?
No, I don't think it was, but that does totally make good sense. I do agree with that sentiment.
Yeah, I seem to remember somebody telling me they didn't want to watch it because everybody looked sweaty, and it was just... Oh, I think it was Chandra, our friend Chandra.
Oh, maybe.
I must say, though, for a space movie, there's surprisingly a lot of underwater scenes in that film. There is, like, 8 underwater scenes in that movie. And I'm like, this is a space movie. What the hell is going on?
Yeah, there isn't that much space in it.
No, there really isn't. It's very bizarre. Yeah. Part of the reason why that movie was pretty frustrating for me, there's multiple times when I was like, wow, this is great. And then 5 minutes later, I'm like, wow, this is horrendous. Like, I was constantly shifting from that back and forth. Yeah.
Yeah. I think the whole conceit of, I think what they call Alpha in the movie, the city, like that idea of like 1,000 planets in one city is awesome. And the idea of space time is cool. Cause then like, how do you interact both of them at once as a cop? You can have cool storytelling there. And I like, this is basically like, this is time cops, in the comic Shifting Waters is just time cops. But you could do different time periods of different planets and how that's interacted with our history. Like there's all kinds of cool story stuff you can do if you're willing to do both.
Right.
Which I think is part of why Doctor Who is such a big thing nowadays. Like, here's a time travel one. That's cool. All right, I don't want to do too much Earth. Here's a planet. All right, cool. That's cool, too. You know, you can mix it up.
It's a lot easier to do as a TV show, that conceit, though, because it's kind of hard to fit all of that into a 2-hour contained storyline.
Yeah.
Yeah. A little more difficult.
That said, though, I did really, really... There's something I love about... I love... shows and movies and comics that show the world going to hell. Like, I didn't like 28 Days Later. I didn't particularly like it, but I like the first, like, 10 minutes where it just shows the world sitting in the chaos. And, like, I don't really like Walking Dead, but the first half of the first season of Fear the Walking Dead, I loved it so much. Fucking fantastic. Just this, like, unnerving sense of the world that this is, like, here today, and then at the end of the season, everything's fucked. There's something about that I just love to watch. And so this comic...
So you like watching the breakdown of society.
Yeah. Yeah. In a way that like... And like the idea of what does it take to get there? And I like that this one does that too. Like the idea like, oh, there's a little bit of water, so everybody in Manhattan just gets the fuck out. Like that may be a little far. But I did like seeing like New York just like overtaken by nature and in shambles, and the storm comes and you can see the skyscrapers falling in and the bridge crumbling down, and like it was really cool. And I think part of the reason that worked so well for me too is the art, the detail and the backgrounds of the artwork in this thing were fucking fantastic. Like it, just when the room that they throw Valerian in, the grocery market or whatever, where he gets just tossed in the beginning after they first capture him. Just like there's so much detail, like broken glass on the floor, and it's just a throwaway panel. You don't need that kind of detail in the art, but putting it in there everywhere just makes something about this setting feel so authentic, in a way that it doesn't have any right to because it's not real. the detail really, really worked in the set pieces. I really did enjoy it a lot.
Yeah, for more of a cartoonish sort of art style, like the detail in it was pretty great. Like I was very impressed.
That was what weird for me though, is the people I feel like are a different art style from the rest of the comic. Am I the only one that got that?
No, because the faces feel a lot more cartoony, and then the backgrounds actually remind me of like old school Batman. You know, where the darkness really stands out, shadow is used very strategically and also very heavily. And, you know, they keep it fairly monochrome, but then you have, you know, the people and they're kind of like, I don't know, their faces are cartoony and they often wear like brightly colored outfits. So.
They are French, you know.
True.
You have to kind of parse it a little bit for that.
Yeah, and I mean the faces too are a little caricature-y. Yeah.
Yeah, and my expectation looking at the cover was not met when we see the characters in there. Because they look, the cover looks kind of John Romita-esque, you know, the square jaws and stuff. But, you know, it was a little bit jarring at first, but then I got used to it. So I won't knock them for it.
I mean, the part of that, too, I mean, Clint, you're making a joke about how it's French, but I think there's something you said about a European art style. And we, as a show, have really not read European comics. I can't really remember another one that we've read. I mean, we've done 304 previous episodes, so it's hard for me to keep them all in my head. But, like, it's, I don't know if we've read any other, but it's entirely reasonable to suspect there's a different art style for Europe than there is for America, even though they were both Western, considering, like, how stark the difference is between, say, anime and American animation. This might just be part of a European style, is that some of the characters are a little more cartoony than you would expect for the art style for the rest of it. And I mean, I'm trying to think too, like a lot of the other European comics that I know of have this kind of style too, but the other ones I can think of are like Asterix and Obelix and Charlie Hebdo. Like, they're all kind of cartoony sort of a feel overall. And they're definitely not this genre. So it's kind of, it's apples and oranges. But I do, my mind identifies this kind of cartoonish caricature drawing of people and faces as being European in art style.
Yeah, I can kind of see that too. And it's also just, you know, for a 70s comic, like, far more detailed than we often see. And I know with the American comics, so much of that was limitation of print.
Yeah, I'm thinking of like Galactus that we read. It was just like black, like yellow sky, pink sky, blue background. I don't want to draw it. There's not time, and the printer can't do the detail anyway. So fuck it.
Yeah, that was like three colors total, the whole thing. They're like, we're not going to try to overlay any colors. But yeah, this one, I think that they. I don't know. I guess it must have been printed as some sort of graphic novel because it's 50 pages. So, but it, you know, it certainly did not suffer from the same limitations of the, like, you know, quick turnaround printing that we see for American comics from the 1960s through the 90s.
Yeah, I mean, the coloring here is a lot more muted than most American comics were then and are today even. There's a lot more, not so bright. But there's definitely a full color palette here, which is not something you would expect from a comic this age. So, I mean, obviously whoever printed this was like, we'll pay the money. We'll make a good run.
And I assume some of it was, digitally touched up for the Kindle edition.
I'd imagine so.
You know, they did use quite a variety of color, per panel for a comic of this age.
All right. Well, I don't really have anything else here. Do you guys have anything we haven't talked up?
Well, I was curious about, like, what... Because this, honestly, I didn't even know this was a thing. Like, I knew that, like, I'd heard of Valerian before the movie, but I had no idea it was a 50-year-old... you know, ongoing comic series and things like that. So, you know, when you mentioned, like, European style, I consider myself pretty versed in comics. Like, I don't even really know much about European comics. I didn't even really think about it before this book. Like, is there a rich European comics tradition that I don't know about? That what?
The 2080 is a whole publisher.
That's right. That's actually one of the few ones I've heard of, but because I really didn't know that there was a parallel comics industry in Europe during the 60s and 70s. I didn't even know that.
Their publishing style is a lot different than what the American, like, Marvel and DC were doing at the same time. Like, they were, the stories were often serialized in a magazine. Like 2000 AD or heavy metal. I guess heavy metal's a little bit later. That was the 80s. But there was a, you know, you would get things, you would get these magazines and you would get ongoing stories. And a lot of them were kind of, were written in that way. Like Andy mentioned Asterix. I quickly looked up on Wikipedia. Asterix and Valerian were published in the same magazine together, from like the mid-60s on. So, and the comics were a lot different. It wasn't necessarily like superhero stuff. Like the European comic that I'm most familiar with prior to this was, Tintin.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Right. And so to me, like I was reminded a lot of, Tintin. There's also, are you familiar with R. Crumb?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Isn't he, I thought he was American, though.
You might be right about that. He was published in these European magazines, though.
Okay. Yeah.
So, the European comics scene, I believe, was more populated with, like, underground stuff. So not comics with the CS ending, but comics with the IX ending. So things that generally in America you would not find to be condoned by the, the comics code. So, you know, things that might, and some of it's like totally family friendly, like Tintin or Valerian or Asterix or Moomin, if Tove Jansson, like that's totally for kids. But there's a lot of it that's like more adult, underground, there were erotic comics, but also just stuff that wouldn't have made it through, you know, what Americans would consider, like, appropriate. So maybe more nudity, more guns, or just themes that were considered more deviant, I guess, for lack of a better word. I think France and Belgium both had, like, a really strong comics scene, underground comics, but I'm not well-read in that, so, like, I can't really name anything.
My quick Wikipedia research confirms that statement.
Woohoo!
Yeah, and that's something I'd even consider, too. When I do think about European comics, I do think of a largely adult audience. Because this 2080 stuff, this Valerian's getting printed around the time Judge Dredd is getting printed in the early years, and that's definitely not a kids-focused comic. And a lot of the stuff I think of as European comics are definitely not for children, but did come out in like the mid-70s when the American market is like, comics are for kids. Comics weren't for adults until the 90s.
I think that's why I didn't really understand the tradition up until very, you know, obviously maybe just the last week or two. I always looked at European comics as those sort of comics, like a Judge Dredd, like as a very adult sort of... they're not even like superheroes necessarily as much as like just stories that have graphic, you know, a graphic setting or a comic setting. Because like that's why I was saying, like, I wasn't aware of like, you know, a big publishing house or necessarily like these iconic characters. I've heard of Valerian and I've heard of Asterix and things like that, but like nothing that I've ever read into in any meaningful way. But yeah, that's it's good to know.
Yeah, and I would say like even like European or English authors, British authors who were published by American imprints like Vertigo, you still see kind of that tradition, like Alan Moore with Swamp Thing and
right.
V for Vendetta. Like, you know, those themes in there, like the anti-fascism, the fear of authority, the sense of rebellion, or like Neil Gaiman's stuff in Sandman, he deals with like AIDS and drug use and like mental illness. these are like far more adult themes, and I think that we tend to see them come a lot from, of course, you know, at this point, not only from, but initially in the 80s, especially, European authors. And I think that comes from a legacy of having more adult themes in their comics then.
Hmm. All right, we'll crack that code.
Boom.
You guys ready to rate this?
Sure.
Sure.
All right, well, like always, at least for the last 5 episodes and hopefully forever moving forward, before we give any number rating and talk about what we did and didn't like and whatever, I first want to thank Pierre Christin, Jean-Claude Mazieres, Evelyn Trianle, and anybody else who was involved in making this comic. Because whether we like a comic or don't like a comic, if somebody didn't put their work into it and somebody didn't put themselves out there to make it, and if somebody didn't go through the effort to get it printed and put it in our hands, we wouldn't be able to talk about it at all. So whether we like it or not, thank those people for doing that work and getting it here and getting it out and doing it, because it's one thing to sit here and be a critic, but you got to appreciate the actual creators too. That in mind, Clint, you're the guest. How about you go first? And just as a reminder, our rating system is completely arbitrary. The numbers are made up, don't mean anything. It's kind of like Whose Line of 1 to 5. So whatever, sure, whatever scale you want to put, give it a 1 to 5.
Let's see. I'll give it a 4 out of 5. I thought it was a really fun read. It was really an interesting kind of throwback to, like, you know, obviously an older 60s sort of golden age of comics feel to it. And I really enjoyed the sort of the art style and you know, it just, maybe from the comics that I've been reading lately, I've been reading a lot of, like, really gritty, sort of dark, noirish comics. And this is it was a nice change of pace for me to read something that was sort of, didn't take itself so seriously and had that sort of, fun sense of adventure about it. So yeah, I'll go a 4 out of 5. I enjoyed it.
If you want to read something that's definitely lighter and doesn't take itself seriously, last week you read Star Wars, Tug and Mink were here. You should give that a read.
Okay.
That's pretty fun.
Okay.
It's definitely funny, especially if you're familiar with Star Wars. You can find out you can find out what happened to the many Bothans.
The many Bothans that died?
Yes, you can find
out. That's lighthearted?
You can find out about them.
All right.
Let's see. David, you go next.
I'm also going to give it a 4. I really enjoyed this. I wasn't sure what to expect, and I was pleasantly surprised. I thought that, like Clint, it was a lot of fun to read, and it was just something different. We haven't really tackled stuff like this, and I liked it enough that I think I would like to read more. So, I'm definitely going to give it a 4.
Nice. Jen?
3.5 for me. I enjoyed this. I thought that it was not the standard 70s comic in a very good way. And I liked that it had kind of like these themes of, you know, adventure and sci-fi and time travel, but at the same time, it overturns some stuff. Like we talked earlier about how the sexism stuff was like subverted, and how the heroic stuff was subverted, and I thought that made for a more interesting read. I am really curious to look at more of the books in this series and just kind of find out more about, you know, what this is. So, 3.5.
See, I'm torn. Part of me wants to give this a 2.5. For me, this is, in terms of how I would read a comic nowadays as a modern reader, because I'm all about that reader response criticism, this was kind of an average read as a modern reader. But I definitely want to give it extra points because coming from where it came from, in our perspective of what comics were like in the mid to late 70s, like, this does a lot of things a lot better than most American comics did. Not just in terms of, like, the color work because of the cost of printing and the quality of print, and not just of the sexism stuff, but like the detail and the setting work and the type of story being told is generally much higher than they were for a lot of comics in the 70s. But I'm also spoiled, like Claremont with the racism subtext is awesome, and Simonson was so good, and there were some really good American comics that did it in the American conceit too. And this, as much as I like it, I don't feel like it had an overarching theme or morality or story or a big theme to sink my teeth into. I can give it tons of props for being way better than it had any right to be in 1978, because it really was. But I think I'm going to give it a 3, which I'm excited to read more. I really do. I like the context of the story. But like Valerian's just kind of a dude. Valerian's just kind of a chick. And then these other characters are going to come up again. Maybe Zombles. But I don't know. I'm all about that rude response, because it's better than it had a right to be. But I mean, if I've got an hour to read comics, I don't think volume 2 of this is the first I'm going to reach for. I feel like there are better comics that have been written since. I mean, it's of course there were. And as much as I like this, there's other things that we've read that I think I like better that I didn't make the time to go back and read either. So yeah, I'm gonna be a 3. It sounds harsh, but that's where I am. I'm gonna give it a 3. Anyway, that's where I am and where we are right now in this part of space-time. But next week, we're gonna read Judge Dredd America by John Wagner, because this was originally gonna be a European comics thing, but then we really wanted to do Star Wars Tag and Make, so it's just sci-fi stuff. But next week is gonna be another European comic. We're gonna read Judge Dredd America, not just because everything we do has to be about America, even if it's a European comic, but also that's supposed to be a good jumping on point for the Dredd franchise, because Dredd franchise is massive. So yeah, Judge Dredd America. If you want to find out what we have going on after that, go to welcometocomics.com. On the left, there will be a button that says Future Shows, and we'll have things planned out ahead of time. You'll find out what we have coming up after Judge Dredd. We're going to talk about what it's like to introduce a new hero in a more modern comic landscape, because it feels like to me every time I see comics, it's just reinventions or legacy versions of characters that have been around forever. Like, it's hard to make a new character, and I want to read some of those attempts, good or bad. That's next week. After that, and then after that, go welcome to Comics to Com future shows. You can also listen to any one of our 304 previous episodes by clicking the past shows button. Odds are we've read your favorite comic or read a comic that you really enjoy. Go check it out. If we haven't read one, there's also a button that says contact. Fill out the form, hit send, it'll go straight to my personal inbox. But if that's not good enough for you, can also find me at Jolly Andy. You can find the show on Facebook. You can follow at Welcome to Comics on Twitter. All those kinds of good things. And if you do like the show, rate, review, subscribe on iTunes, or go to patreon.com and subscribe for as little as a penny. Show us that you love us, or subscribe for more and get neat little perks. And basically just keep the lights on. We're a relatively cheap, efficient show. I'm never going to ask you to pay for my comics. But you know, the web hosting ain't cheap. A little bit of help would be nice if you got some time, if you got a quarter. But yeah, patreon.com/welcometocomics. Yeah, that's it for this week. Until next week, everybody. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Bye.